Hello everyone and welcome to this webinar. I'm Francis Seeley from GlobalNet 21 and Enfield Climate Action Forum. And today we've got Beryl D'Souza with us. Now, she's a plastic surgeon and she also lectures on that. And she's also an activist. She believes she should take her practice, if you like, her ideas out into the community in terms of how the community perceives their health. And we're going to talk to her about that and what she does and how medics and practitioners should relate to the community. So, you know, welcome, Beryl, to this webinar. And first, could you briefly just tell us a little about yourself?
Thank you, Francis. Thank you for inviting me to this webinar. Well, I grew up in Tanzania in East Africa and came to the UK when I was a teenager in 1977. I studied biochemistry at Chelsea College initially, and then went on to do research into nerve regeneration at the Royal College of Surgeons of England in Lincoln's Inn Fields. After that, I went into medicine as a postgraduate student, and I studied at St. Bartholomew's Hospital in London. And I went on to complete my surgical training and thereafter my plastic surgery training in the Pan-Thames rotation, which so that is in London. I took 6 months off for my first child and 6 weeks off my second child. And I've stayed in plastic surgery in London ever since. I'm very much interested in teaching, and I'm a honorary senior lecturer in plastic surgery, clinical lecturer at Imperial College in London. I'm also very much involved in a lot of community groups in the area I live in Enfield.
Well, let me ask you about that. I mean, you just told us about your professional background, but you're also a trustee, aren't you, in the Enfield Racial Equality Council? And so in what way have you been promoting health there?
Okay, as a trustee of Enfield Racial Inequality Council, I've worked with my fellow trustees to address the health inequalities in the Black and minority ethnic groups and to lobby for improvements in health service provision for these varied groups. And as you might have seen on the Enfield Racial Inequality Council website, we've very much involved in an improving health project in 2010. And that's when I started to get involved with Eric. And this culminated in a conference. Eric has a voice in Enfield Council and with the CCG to put forward any concerns we have for the communities in Enfield.
Okay, so you're involved with Eric, and as you know, we're talking about climate change. And I mean, are you of the view that the World Health Organization is that the climate crisis is also a health crisis?
Absolutely. I think it's the most pressing health and humanitarian challenge of the 21st century. And the WHO statistics are depressing, as what they say is 250,000 of people are expected to die every year from climate change between 2030 and 2050. And so we can't just do nothing. We have to act and do something.
And do you think that the recent heat wave and the excess heat that we've all suffered is a wake-up call that's made people think about that? Or have they really got the message yet? Is there still a lot of work to do?
I think the UK had its first amber warning issued by the Met Office in July 2020 for the heat wave. And this has certainly raised awareness of the dangers of extreme heat. We know that elderly and children were the most affected, and the daily routine and work was disrupted to accommodate what was happening with regards to the temperature changes. And yes, so we do have more work to do. And in fact, the heat wave has brought to light the effects of climate change and the consequences.
I mean, the thing about climate change, the thing about excess heat, the thing about drought and so on, is it tends to affect, doesn't it, the more deprived, the poorer, the more marginalised members of our communities, both globally and locally. And they're the ones who will suffer the most, aren't they?
Yes, well, the United Nations have showed that 80% of people displaced by climate change are women and are more likely to die or be harmed by extreme weather or natural disasters. For local communities, it would mean addressing fair sharing and equitable distribution of the benefits and burdens of climate change. We're talking about equality, human rights and collective rights of the individuals. So yes, we know that marginalized members of the communities will be affected.
Of course, when we talk about marginalized communities, some people think, it's global communities, it's people in the Horn of Africa, it's people in Bangladesh and so on. But it's here as well, isn't it? The more marginalized communities here will also be affected. In Paris in 2003, 2019, it was people who were elderly, living alone, socially isolated, and mainly women who suffered, and many, many died. So it happens here in the developed countries. Marginalized communities are also affected the most.
Yes, well, studies in the UK have found that the poorer communities tend to live in low quality natural environments where there are fewer trees and parks and experience higher exposure to air pollution. This means they're most likely to suffer from climate change for those very reasons.
How do you get that message over, though? Because it's really difficult. I mean, going around, we've been doing surveys and trying to find out what people's concerns are. And, you know, some people are saying, well, you know, climate change is a real problem, but we're suffering now from a cost of living crisis. We're suffering from food poverty and fuel poverty, and we're worried about our immediate future. So how do you get over to them the message that climate change is also about that and could make and will actually make that much worse?
So I think the problem here is that we have to get the government to act to reduce greenhouse emission and adopt measures to protect people socially, economically, culturally, politically and institutionally, or otherwise the vulnerable people are going to suffer as a result of climate change.
But how do you get that message over to them if you're on the street doing a survey and they're saying, look, I'm really finding it difficult buying food, the prices are going up all the time, this is my main concern? Climate change is an existential crisis, the most serious we've ever faced, but when they're faced with an immediate crisis, how do you get the message over to them? Telling them that the government should do something doesn't always bear water because they are struggling.
I think as medical practitioners, we need to work with the most disadvantaged, and the recommendation by the Climate and Health Council in the UK gave six steps and a formula for what we can do. And this is not just general practitioners. I think it's up to secondary care doctors as well. So these doctors working in the hospital, consultants working in the hospital. So the first one is to encourage exercise. So walking and cycling and exercise generally to improve cardiovascular health. And the second is to reduce meat consumption, because we know that reducing meat consumption will reduce carbon dioxide emission. And then community awareness is the third point. So support patients to get green grants, so say insulation for their homes or more ventilation in hot weather. And the fourthly is social prescribing. So this would apply mainly to individuals who live on their own, who are socially isolated, to get more involved in social projects, such as gardening projects. And fifthly is that I think all of us in the medical profession need to act as climate change champions. So making sure we have climate change on the agenda at our meetings, at every committee we're at, and in that way we can collectively influence policy change with the government. And then lastly, I think it's up to us as individuals to set an example, to show that we ourselves are trying to do things to ensure that we remain healthy. So reducing our energy bills by, say, not taking the car to work if it's possible, by walking or cycling, or I'll give an example at work. At the moment, we have a lunchtime walking group where we just get out of the office and the secretaries and the doctors and nurses and just go for a walk in the local park for half an hour. So in that way, we're getting our lunchtime exercise and we get a chance to sort of make sure that we're out of the work environment for a short period of time.
So you're telling us what medical practitioners can do and how they can help people to confront the consequences of climate change. But it's also important, isn't it, to find out what local people feel, what their concerns are. We can go in and we can say, you should walk, you should actively travel, you should eat less meat. But we need to find out what they think, don't we? And so do you think what we're doing in Info Climate Action Forum and ERIC to reach those communities through community hubs and community panels is an important way to do that?
I think engaging with the local community is really important. Putting the message across as to what the consequences are of climate change and empowering these local communities and the individuals as to what they can do and how they can get involved to work towards influencing policy change is something that Enfield Racial Equality Council and NCAF are doing very effectively, and it's bringing it to light. So we, working with yourself, have had our meetings, our online meetings, where we've had representatives from the local community voicing their concerns and giving solutions to the problems. So I think making sure the community is involved is important, but not forgetting, as medical practitioners, how we can actually do something about it because we're in a position to do so.
When you do it though, and when we're doing it, and we're doing it very soon, you can't really get people in and talk about public health and climate change. It's sort of too abstract, isn't it? You have to build it around issues that you know concern them, like air pollution, lack of green space, as you said, active travel, healthy eating, and so on. How important is it to really relate to the community out there in a way that is relevant to them?
Well, I think here in Enfield, we know that we have 123 parks and open spaces with more than 900 hectares of land. We're also lucky to have a gardening college, Capel Manor Gardening College, of which I'm affiliated with. I'm a governor of the Gardening College, which offers gardening courses. And so there is potential to educate the community, for example, on growing their own food produce and using the parks. And in fact, Enfield have been very good in using the parks for exercise and for events so that people are out there using the green space that we're lucky to have in our borough.
Okay, so those are the things we can do, but I was just wondering, You know, whether GPs have to rethink and medics generally have to rethink about the models they work with. For example, I noticed in one website you talked about relationship-centered models of healthcare. Now, that sounds quite a big change in culture for medics in a way. I mean, what does it mean and how useful would it be to use that model of creating relationships in a time of climate change?
So the relationship-centered model of healthcare is fundamentally the relationship between the patient and the care providers. So it includes the whole care team, so not just the practitioner, but the nurse, the care coordinator, the social worker, the health coach. So they are all involved in delivering the healthcare system to that individual. So it's a useful concept to have, especially at this time of the climate change crisis, because there are things that can be done. So another example I'll give you here is for elderly people. We know that the pandemic, the COVID pandemic, affected elderly people a lot because they were not able to get out, so they were not able to walk long distances. And so we are now left with an elderly population who are at high risk of falls. And if they fall, they're more likely to fracture their hips. And so therefore, the organization such as Age UK in Enfield, again, another organization that I'm affiliated with as a trustee, provides a fall prevention workshop whereby individuals are assessed and given exercises in order to ensure that they can go on to confidently be able to walk with low risk of fall, so improving their cardiovascular function as well. And so the referral has to be made by the GP, but this is an organization that's involved. The social care worker can be involved as well, and a healthcare worker, just to ensure that the individual has a good diet and so on. So the whole idea of relationship centered model of healthcare means that you're bringing in a whole army of healthcare and allied healthcare professionals to be involved with the individual. And this can be done at a community level as well.
That is about statutory collaborative networks, but to what extent should medics feel the need to go out in the community and do things? I mean, last week I interviewed two medics who got arrested outside JP Morgan for breaking the glass because JP Morgan was financing oil companies. I mean, to what extent are medics becoming aware that they've got to go beyond just developing these relationships, but have got to go out and become community activists as well?
I think the medical profession is noted for altruism, and it is an inherent part of the medical profession. So doctors are very much involved in their local communities as volunteers, as governors, as trustees. And so they are able to provide for the local communities, to support the local communities, to act as advocates and to influence policy change at a local level. And obviously when doctors are involved with it and with these sort of issues at a national level with organizations, they have more impact nationally and globally. So, but I think with regard to how much doctors can do, doctors have a busy work life too. And so you'll find the doctors who very much get involved vary depending on how busy their home lives are, their family lives are, and how busy their work life is in the hospital. But I think inherently this altruism that's inherent in the medical profession, in doctors, means they will get involved and they will do something.
But does it mean going beyond the model of social prescribing, though? Is there, are there other ways that doctors can relate to the community?
As I've said, with doctors engaging with the community in different ways, as trustees or volunteers or governors, is one way of doing it. But then the awareness about what's happening in the community, that happens through the media and also from our own profession, the British Medical Association, the BMA. We get information from the BMA about what we need to do. We get our organization will aid us in what we can do and what we can do. And obviously there's some doctors who are more activists than others and will be doing things just as the example you gave about the doctors at the JP Morgan office. But I think we work in different ways in order to try and influence change. And I think all of these ways in the main are good ways.
Well, I was going to ask you about your work with Eric and whether that was an example of that. And in a way, you've answered that. So I won't ask you that again because you do a lot of work there. But I mean, do you think that one of the things you have to do as a doctor and we have to do as community activists is try to change lifestyles or encourage people to change lifestyles and also to develop community resilience? Or does it go beyond that?
I think most medics probably do the work that I'm doing in my local community. I think it's very much what you can do and how much change you can make, and that is very much dependent on the groups you're involved with. So, for instance, Enfield Racial Equality Council have taken it upon themselves to actually address the issue about climate change and to get the awareness in the local community groups, the members of Enfield Racial Equality Council. And so that's a noble thing. And as a trustee of the organization, I want to facilitate and I want to aid what they're doing. In that sense, but for community resilience, which is defined as the sustained ability of a community to use available resources such as energy or food or transport, etc., and it's knowing how you can respond or recover from the adverse situation, and so this will allow for adaptation and growth of a community. And I think the pandemic in itself was something that really showed how much can be done in the community. We know with the pandemic how the local charity groups, another organization I'd like to mention is the Felix Project, which is an organization that distributes surplus foods to charities and local communities. And this is done with a lot of volunteer help. Food was provided to individuals in their homes, and to local communities, to schools, to church groups, to community groups, with the help of the volunteers making sure that the food gets distributed. So I think what's happened in a way is that the pandemic has shown how much can be done and how much resilience there is in the community. And so I think now is the time to use those same community organizations to say, well, okay, we've got through the pandemic, but now we need to know how we're going to cope with a heat wave, how we're going to cope with the winter crisis. Those are things that we should be thinking about.
So that's community resilience, but I mean, is there an important role for health practitioners also to put pressure on their own organisation and other statutory bodies and the government about structure changes, like dealing with heat and, you know, having places where people can go for refuge, flood alleviation and so on. And also to put pressures on your own organisation. I mean, in the North London Mid, they have a sustainability group that works with their management to try and make it greener. Is there an important role there as well?
I think the health service is constantly making structural changes, and this is always on the agenda, and we know that already. The health service is getting prepared for the winter crisis because we know where there's poverty, where there's cold, and people not getting their meals, there's going to be a high rate of illness and sickness. And so therefore the preparation is something that the government is doing. But again, in the community, it's gearing up for that as well. And with the healthcare professional, it's making sure patients are safe and they have the actual support that's needed on them for them, and we can see that and we can assess that, because when we see our patients, we have to ask about their social circumstances. So if you know that someone's on their own, you want to know, you know, are they eating well, are they able to go out, are they, and you know, what's their mobility like. So all of those things are important things that we have to address. And that takes time, because if you are seeing patients in a clinic and you have a limited time, it's very difficult to actually make sure that your patient is safe in their home environment and address any issues they have with the, you know, the allied health profession as part of the caregiving that they need.
Okay, well, we're getting very close to the end of our 30 minutes now. And let me ask you, I mean, Steve Barnett, who's chief executive of the NHS Confederation, he's argued that the health of the planet and the health of people are inseparable. Now, is that the message that you would like to get across? And how big a challenge is it?
So I think the main thing, the challenge, is getting the government and decision makers to produce concrete policies and action plans here based on scientific expertise and knowledge, and ensuring that the recommendations made by the experts are implemented by the government, and so facilitating all of that is going to be difficult, especially as it'll need financial resources to do so. But that is why we need to be cognizant of the fact that we need to keep this on the agenda at all times. So at all times, and so being a champion for this is something that we should take on as an extra role in our profession.
Okay, so if anybody wanted to find out more about what you do or follow up on the work you do, you know, either as a medic in the community or the work you do for Eric or whatever you do, I mean, how would they do with that? How would they go about it?
Well, I think I've touched on all the organisations that are supporting the local community groups. So I've mentioned Enfield Racial Inequality Council, I've mentioned Age UK Enfield, I've mentioned the Felix Project, and I've also mentioned the Cable Manor Gardening College, as you know, we're lucky to have as a gardening college in our borough. So these are all the organisations that are out there that are involved in the communities, and they support the communities and the people who are involved in these organizations are part of the community because they're volunteers who volunteer in the community. So looking at these organizations, you will see what they do. And I am part of these organizations because I'm involved with these organizations. And I think they all sort of merge and mesh in together because they all are involved in the good work of looking after the communities here in Enfield.
Okay, and of course there's NCAF as well, and we're involved in that and working with Eric on this project, and we have.
Yes,
you know,
of course, yes. I didn't mention
that's all right.
In organisation. Yeah,
and we have 130 civil society groups working with us, which is great. Anyhow, I mean, you know, thank you for doing that because I think that was really interesting, and you talked about a lot of things there, about the way in which practitioners can work with the community, what they can do to develop lifestyle changes, community resilience, how people can develop relationship models through collaborative networks within your profession, and so on. So it's been quite a wide-ranging discussion in a short amount of time. So I think we've covered a lot of territory, really, and it's been really worthwhile doing. So, Beryl, thank you for doing that. Thank you for joining us. And we'll end this interview now.
Thank you very much for having me, and it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you.